Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you. You can watch the program by going to Ustream channel, searching for Gary Null. Today, our guest in the second part of our program will be Professor Harvey Wasserman. He's professor of history at Columbia State University and Capital University in Ohio. We're going to talk about Fukushima, new information. Now, we had Professor Carl Grossman on last week. We have even more information on what's happening with the nuclear plumes that are crossing the Atlantic or Pacific. Also, you would never imagine who is now suggesting that as a way of helping global warming, the solution should be building nuclear power plants. We're going to get to that because I would never have guessed that these people who are head of the environmental movement would be now lining up behind President Obama's pro-nuke position, but they are. Also, from the environmental segment today, if you thought that the solar flares was yesterday's issue, think again. 28 solar flares in the last 7 days and more coming. That's according to the Los Angeles Times. Also, the plant production, meaning the ability to raise plants, is declining. Why? Because the soil is losing its nutrients. How's that happening? I'll explain that. Also, how healthy eating improves farming communities and the environment. And then something I've been concerned about is the thawing of the permafrost. One of the largest permafrosts in the world is in the Russian mountain area, Siberia, the steppes. Well, according to the latest report just out today, the speed of coastal erosion in eastern Siberia has doubled. Remember, I've been mentioning there is no such thing as an accurate mathematical model, because once something begins to tip, you cannot predict what will happen from them. Well, it's tipping. Also today, a part of a five-part series on examining the lies, the big lies, about vaccines are safe and effective, and the excuses they've given. Almost every physician will tell you vaccination was responsible for overcoming smallpox and the entire epidemic, and measles and polio. Wrong, wrong, wrong. But how would you know? You have the authority of the physician with all their training, and you have the belief by some activists. Well, let's go to the history books. And today we begin a series. The first part is called What About Those Old Days? And I'm going to be quoting from Roman Bastrinic and Suzanne Humphrey, MD, from Dissolving Illusions. And I'll give my own and personal interpretations because I grew up in an era and at a time and place where you could see the impact of generations living in dire poverty in Appalachian, West Virginia, where I lived. I actually wrote a book on it. In fact, it was the first book that I'd ever written. I was still in high school when I started it, along with a classmate, Jim Dawson. It was called Parkersburg, an early Portrait. And I had a chance to sit with some people who were in their 90s, who had photo albums going back into the 1800s and talking about what life was like. And for probably 2 years, I interviewed hundreds and hundreds of old people because they're the ones who had the photographs that I would use in building the story. But today, if you look back, you think of a more bucolic time, a better time. Well, I guess for some it was. So when we look back at the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, and we think that a vaccine is what caused all that suffering to go away, we haven't been honest. In fact, none of the movies, the romantic period pieces, are not honest, because it's what they don't show you that was the cause of the disease. And the eradication of that living condition is what caused the improvement, not the vaccines. But this will be a five-part series, and we'll take you through it step by step. So you have an authentic history with documentation, everything fully referenced, and all sources fully quoted. We've been told that ultrasound is important, and every pregnant woman wants to get ultrasound because she wants to know about, you know, her child, the developing fetus. Here's the latest. This is from a Dr. Manuel Casanova, medical doctor, neurologist, who holds the endowed chair at the University of Louisville in Kentucky. Ultrasound causes brain damage in fetuses. Quote, ultrasound has become routine during pregnancy over the last 30 years. It is assumed to be safe, though safety was never investigated. Research is now finally being done, and the results are dismal, demonstrating clear and permanent brain damage. As shown in this study, nearly all babies have been damaged to varying degrees, resulting in abnormal neurological conditions becoming the new norm. End quote. So when this study was done, it confirmed a disturbing hypothesis that the doctor and his colleagues had been testing for the last 3 years, that ultrasound exposure is an environmental factor directly contributing to the exponential rise in autism. Here's where it gets interesting. A doctor, Pasco Rakic, is the head researcher for the study documenting that ultrasound damages mouse brains. It shows that the process of brain development is disturbed in mice, though it's easy to suggest that this is only a study on mice, so it doesn't prove anything about humans. That's not true. The method of development in mouse brains is exactly the same in all mammals. Therefore, if ultrasound has an adverse effect on mice brains, then it must also have the same effect on human brains. Now, how do we know this? All right, let's look at the brain cells that are arranged in a random manner. The brain's gray matter controls muscles and sensory perception and emotions and memory. The gray matter cells form columns, which can function as a unit. The cells are also arranged in rows that are parallel to the surface of the brain. You can think of the brain cells as being arranged in a grid, like a graph. Each cell forms a part of a column and a row, though the row is actually curved to match the surface of the brain. Now, if developing cells do not end up where they should be, behavioral problems and epilepsy can arise from the misarrangement. And it's obvious that anything capable of causing such misarrangements can produce disabilities. Therefore, Dr. Rakic's study is particularly disturbing. Why? A fetus's neurons are formed in the area just above the cerebellum, sometimes called the primitive brain, and they progress towards the outer surface of the brain. Now, during the process, they are moved outwards, parallel to the brain's surface. The study reports goes into some detail about how this process happens, but for our purposes, there's no need to address it. How and when this process occurs is well understood, though the means by which cells move radially away from the column in which they start is not well understood. What is known, though, is that the process is very sensitive and can be affected by many biological and physical and chemical agents. For example, repeated exposure to toxic environments can do this. Alcohol, drugs, neurotropic viruses, ionizing radiation, all these can cause misplacement of neurons and behavioral deficits. And the numbers in the study also document that it can also result in displacement of neurons, and you end up with all forms of problems, including, not the least of which, could be autism spectrum disorder. So something brand new that we should be paying attention to. We thank Heidi Stevenson from WakingTimes.com for doing this investigation and bringing this to our attention. So understand that sound waves also cause exposure at a level that people were never imagining. According to Heidi, pregnant mice were given doses of ultrasound for times ranging from 5 to 420 minutes. Now, if you look at the graphs, the pregnant mice were placed in glass tubes with cutouts to deliver ultrasound to their fetuses. An acoustic gel was applied to the posterior half of the mouse, and a water bag was placed on the side opposite the ultrasound device to minimize any sound wave reflection or standing waves. And And that caused displacement. So now we know, unless it's a life or death situation, don't do ultrasound. And think of all the pregnant people who get it. How about almost everyone? Big problem. Last night, and for the past 24 hours, I was out of town. I was in Miami, Atlanta, Charlotte, North Carolina. I had some important work to do and on an investigation. And I spend time in airports. And almost inevitably, someone comes over and starts up a conversation. Someone who's watched a PBS documentary or listened to the radio, read a book. And one of the people that was having a conversation with me while I was waiting on my New York flight last night said, "You don't really believe in this vegetarian stuff because our ancestors were meat eaters." Now, that's a fact. And I said, and by what standard of historical reference are you suggesting that they were meat eaters? And he cited some book. And I said, "Well, that's a book. It's a book meant to promote a diet. And we've had a lot of books promoting a high-protein diet and the drinking person's diet, the bagel diet. It doesn't mean that it's correct." And I said, "Listen to today, and I'll give you some more accurate information. It's based upon real science. And here it is, for those of you who wonder about what our earliest ancestors on this planet, I'm talking about people going back 3 to 3.5 million years ago. According to Oxford University, and a team there, a Professor Julia Thorpe of Oxford University, and also researchers in Chad and France, they analyzed the carbon isotope ratios in the teeth and bone and found a diet that was significant in foods derived from C4 plants. Well, what does that mean? That means tropical grasses and sedges. That's what it means. So this is the most accurate information we have to date of the diets of the earliest ancestors. Now, these are specialists in isotope analysis of fossil teeth enamel from the Research Laboratory for Archaeology and History of Art. Quote, "We found evidence suggesting that early hominins in Central Africa at least ate a chief diet composing of tropical grasses and sedges. No African great apes, including chimpanzees, eat this type of food, despite the fact it grows in abundance in tropical and subtropical regions. The only notable exception is the savanna baboon, which still forages for these types of plants today. We were surprised to discover that early hominins appear to have consumed more than even the baboons." Now, of course, diets changed over a period of time. But what we know is that it was more difficult to survive in the forest, and it was easier in the plains, because there you could actually have enough sun and soil to grow grasses or to consume them. And then after they developed the art of cultivation, to know what would grow if you planted it. And also you had almost unlimited supplies, and you really weren't competing with other creatures that were abundant for those same grasses and roots. So you're looking at roots, you're looking at shoots, you're looking at grasses, you're looking at stripping down bark of different plants and eating the bulbs. That's what they ate. They didn't eat meat, except very rarely. And that's the oldest ones. From Patrick Malone, "Urologists who own radiation equipment use it more and probably unnecessarily." Quote, "According to a study in the New England Journal of Medicine, many urologists are making decisions about treatment for their prostate cancer patients based upon whether or not they own intensity modulating radiation therapy or IMRT facilities." Why? Because it's a round of treatment that the doctor owns is about $35,000 per treatment course. But before they were financially invested in radiation equipment, the same doctors prescribed therapy for a smaller number of individuals. So it's enormously profitable. So if you're a man and you've been told you must take certain tests, ask them, do you own this equipment? All right. If it's in the office, more often than not, they do. I was listening, actually. It was on BBC. And a physician was talking about the whole idea of a new discovery in Alzheimer's research. And it was just great new research. And the issue was this. They finally found that there are genes that respond to inflammation in the brain, similar to an autoimmune response, but she wouldn't say it absolutely, but was thinking it might contribute and therefore could lead to potential gene-altering medication that could have anti-inflammatory properties. That, to me, is one of the dumbest things I've ever heard. It shows you the dinosaurs, the intellectual medical dinosaurs that permeate all of medicine, all of science. The fact that anyone with an IQ above 12 would know that everybody consumes pro-inflammatory agents, or just the act of exercising is pro-inflammatory. And the brain is no exception. And anything that gets in the brain that is a heavy metal or a toxin causes extreme oxidative distress in the brain, and that can damage it, and then how it damages it can then manifest in some form of amyloid plaque. So the idea is, and should have been, that why don't we look at all the different things that are inflammatory and then eliminate these as much as we can from our lifestyle? And then is there any way that we can repair damage to tissues? And the answer is yes, we can identify what causes inflammation, and yes, we can repair a lot of that damage. But they're not saying this. They're again, looking at only at a gene and the fact that it's a revelation to them. Well, we could bring them an awful lot of people who today don't have their arthritis, bursitis, itises, are not advanced Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and multiple sclerosis, all pro-inflammatory, because they shifted from pro-inflammatory lifestyle to anti-inflammatory. It's just amazing how far down in this understanding of cause and effect is. Finally, higher levels of vitamin C will cause less stomach cancer. This is from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and they did this study and found out that the more vitamin C you take, the less likely you are to have stomach cancers. Well, that's good. Among other things, it can diminish. Now, from our environmental segment, this is from the Los Angeles Times, and here's what it says. From Deborah Netburn, the sun has erupted more than 24 times over the last week, sending radiation and solar material hurtling through space, and scientists say more eruptions may be coming. This shouldn't be unusual, after all. We're technically at solar maximum, the peak of the 11-year cycle of the sun's activity. But this has been a noticeable mellow solar maximum, with the sun staying fairly quiet through the summer. So when our life-giving star suddenly lets loose with 24 medium-strength M-class solar flares and 4 significantly stronger X-class flares in just 7 days, it felt like a surprise. And many of the flares originated from sunspot AR 1884, a particularly active region of the sun that is currently facing Earth, almost at the center of the star. If this region stays active, it will continue to hurl radiation and solar material our way for about another week until it rotates out of sight. A sunspot is an area of the sun where magnetic fields have gotten all twisted up. Quote, you get a tangled bunch of magnetic fields, and they get too tangled and too stressed, and they end up erupting, said Holly Gilbert, a solar physicist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight. Okay, so for those of you who thought, oh, that passed, it hasn't passed. Now, for those of us who study or practice organic farming, we know that one of the first things you have to do is build up the health of the soil. Now, there are many ways you do that. You take everyday items. If you have a garden and trees, leaves, you use the leaves. The scraps of food. Anything that's non-toxic, you put into a compost heap, and you put in the necessary bacteria in a period of time, It builds up a high internal heat, and it biodegrades this down until you end up having a nice, rich loamy soil. And then you can put that on the existing soil, and that's what you grow in, because now you have a nutrient medium that the seed needs in order to germinate, and then the follicles of the newly germinated plant uses for its growth. That's at least if you're growing in the soil. The trouble is, most people are unaware that the droughts we've been going through have baked out the soil, causing massive nutrient erosion, meaning the winds carry that dried up soil thousands of miles away. This is what happened in the Great Dust Bowl. And by the way, the Great Dust Bowl is back. And if you doubt me, just think of Phoenix, Arizona, with multi-million-dollar homes in some areas and water theme park. You have all this stuff in a completely non-sustainable environment. And then one day you look outside and you realize that's not dust, that's sand. Well, you get hit with a sand blast, that can do some damage to you, your property, livestock, anything that gets in the way of it. And that's all because there's so much topsoil that is eroded. This is from the staff writers of Seed Daily in Flagstaff, Arizona. Quote, as dry lands of the world become even drier, water will not be the only resource in short supply. Levels of nutrients in the soil will likely be affected, and their imbalance could affect the lives of one-fifth of the world's population. By the way, that's over 1.5 billion people. That includes people living in Arizona who may be in for a dustier future. The findings are presented in a study published in Nature that details how soil changes may occur and discusses the implications. And one of the people in that was a professor of forest soil and ecology at Northern Arizona University. So understand that, quote, most of the 17 nutrients that plants need to grow to their potential are soil resources such as nitrogen and phosphorus. The statistical model he helped develop for the study suggests that the climate becomes more arid, nitrogen will be decreased and phosphorus will increase. Both are essential for plant growth and both are typical components of fertilizer, but both need to be around in the right quantities for plant growth to proceed more efficiently. It's like a situation where you're making hamburgers but run out of beef. You just can't slip in a bun and still produce a hamburger. Dry lands, which are defined by predominantly lower levels of moisture, cover about 41% of the Earth's surface. Yep, and about 100% of Arizona. So keep that in mind. You got to have soil in order to grow things. And there are 17 states that they just don't have that. Also, good news of how eating healthy improves farming communities and the environment from EcoWatch. Eating, as this audience knows, fresher, healthier foods, it's not just good for our bodies. It improves the health of our farmland, environment, and rural communities. Now, how's this work? Well, the Union for Concerned Scientists uses economic modeling techniques to estimate the effects of changing food consumption on agricultural land use. Here's what they say, quote, the report looked at what would happen if Americans ate fruit and vegetables at USDA recommended levels. The modeling techniques predicted consumption of fruits and vegetables would increase by 173% over current levels, and farmers would grow 88% more of these foods. So if meat and dairy consumption fell to levels recommended by the Harvard University School of Public Health, the study found farmers would grow less corn and other grain commodities used as livestock feed. 8 million acres of land would be saved. Reduced demand for meat would lower agriculture's contribution to global warming. Remember, the global warming is up to 17% from animals because they give off methane, and methane is more toxic to the contribution of global warming than is normal pollutants that we as humans exhale or that machines and cars and boats and planes and trains give off carbon dioxide. So growing more fruits and vegetables and less of the commodity crops that currently dominate U.S. agriculture would produce healthier soil, healthier water, healthier air, as well as provide economic benefits in the form of job growth and increased access to healthy foods for farm communities. And by the way, only 2%, let me repeat that, only 2% of U.S. cropland is now used to grow fruits and vegetables. 59% is devoted to commodity crops, you guessed it, genetically engineered corn, soybeans. They use, and that's used for meat, processed foods, high in high fructose corn syrup, and biofuels like ethanol that I'm opposed to. So that is good news that we, the people, can start demanding more fruits and vegetables, and a lot of people should be getting back to the land and starting their own sustainable organic farms. That would help on all levels. Also, when I gave a mention recently about one of the things we could do nutritionally to help men who are having erectile dysfunction was the nutrient choline, which would be stimulating in the brain, but also L-arginine. And anyone who has herpes or an active virus, just be aware that you should take less of L-arginine because it can stimulate what you have. It doesn't create it. And but normally the amount that you'd have to take of L-arginine would be higher than that which we would be benefiting from before you start to get, in most cases, a outbreak. But it's just something to keep in mind. Now to a special series of looking at the truth behind the claims that it's the vaccines that should receive 100% of the credit for eradication, major killers of the past, specifically smallpox. We're going to start there. I've been to London many times, and what I really enjoy is how well documented in their National Library, in their archives, in the history museums, the history of what it was like. And I like to go to different places and ask people who are there as caretakers, especially in the country, what would it have been like if you had awakened 200, 300 years ago and on this property? And they give you interesting stories, and they're extremely well informed. And that's where we begin, because what we've never looked at is the lack of hygiene. Now, you've heard me mention many times that hygiene is crucial to health. And I believe it was last year I said, what do you believe would happen if for 1 year we stopped all sanitation pickup of all garbage on Fifth Avenue? That any building that had any kind of maintenance problem, whether it's a boiler that was broken so people couldn't get hot water, or windows that were broken but couldn't be repaired, or doors that were broken and couldn't be secured. How long do you think it would be before Fifth Avenue would just become, like many other areas, a dilapidated eyesore, and then be labeled as a ghetto? And then I was using that as a comparison to a whole community that had been neglected by the state and the government, and then fell into disrepair, and then they all criticized it because it was a high crime area, but no one took responsibility for how did it get there. Negligence is what got it there. But before it was negligent, it was a thriving and wonderful and low crime area where people had a quality of life. But in Europe, there was never a time where there was equality. There's always been disparity. But even there was a time when the kings of Europe, in the palaces, didn't even have a toilet, had no running water. But they were wealthy, so they had servants that could come around throughout the day. And they would retire to a private room sometimes. In other cases, it wasn't always private. There were times when some of the kings of England would actually take a small group of people into a private chamber that was not actually his bedroom. But they would sit there and watch as the king went through the morning rituals of whatever it was they were doing, changing his bedclothes into his daily clothes, combing his hair, whatever. But you actually watched this, and you had a chance for, you know, idle conversation. We never hear about this part of history, but it's true. It happened. Wellesley's castle was one of the first, if not the first, to actually have running water that you could use in a way of getting rid of waste. Otherwise, they brought by these little chamber pots, and a person would go in, and then you would have an attendant take it out into a field and throw it away. What if you were the average person? Where did you go to the bathroom? Well, depend upon where you lived. But it all went in the street. If you were at the ground level, you just threw a bucket out. If you were upstairs, you threw it out the window. And people develop this idea that this terrible stench should just be a normal part of living. So now we're going to take a look at the not-so-good old days. Many of us have a picture of the 1800s colored by a myriad of filters that impart a nostalgic and romantic view of that era. And you may picture a time when gentlemen callers arrived to meet a well-dressed lady in a finely furnished parlor, a time where people leisurely drifted down a river on a paddle boat and while sipping mint juleps, a time of more elegant travel abroad, a steam engine passing through the beautiful countryside, or a stylish woman dressed in a long flowing gown descending a sleek horse-drawn carriage with the help of a dapper companion in a top hat. And you may think of those times where life was simple and ordered, a seeming utopia free of many of the woes that plague modern society. But those are all illusions, and we look at them today through filters. And the filter removes the more objective light that we need to see the true picture that emerges. Instead, imagine a world where workplaces had no health, safety, or minimum wage laws. Some kids as young as 4 years old would be put to work each day, 12-hour days. And of course, they died. The average work day in the 1800s was about 16 hours a day, and the most tedious menial labor. Imagine bands of children roaming the streets out of control because their parents were laboring long days. Children were also involved in dangerous and demoralizing work. Picture the New York City surrounded not by suburbs, by rings of smoldering garbage dumps and shanty towns, cities where hogs, horses, and dogs in their refuge were commonplace in the streets. Many infectious diseases were rampant throughout the world, particularly in the larger cities. And yet, this is not a description of a third world country, but a large portion of what the United States and other civilized Western countries used to be like, and that was just a century ago. Quote, "The good old days when everything, in particular human health, was supposedly better than it is today are a myth. The documented history of Western civilizations describes endless and unromantic struggle with sickness and death, tragically high infant mortality and premature death of young adults. Death-dealing epidemics attacked helpless communities nearly as often as summer and winter came to pass and were followed every few years by major catastrophes. In Victorian England, the average age of death among the urban poor was 16 years old." Now, during the 1800s, the number of factories grew along with the rapidly increasing population, which resulted in a flood of people from the countryside in the towns and cities looking for work. The population of the city of London, England, increased by almost 900% in the 19th century. Why? Simple. Industrialization rapidly multiplied threats to health because of an enormous simultaneous growth of towns. Quote, "In 1750, about 15% of the population lived in towns. By 1880, 80% were living in urban areas. In 1801, 1 in 5 workers was employed in manufacturing and linked occupations. By 1871, that had climbed to 2 in 3. The largest city in the Western world, London, had 800,000 inhabitants in 1801. By 1841, its population had grown by a further 1 million, and at the death of Queen Victoria in 1901, the heart of the empire in London contained 7 million inhabitants. Housing could not accommodate the population explosion, which resulted in overcrowding and a remarkable buildup of human and animal waste. In some cases, large buildings, originally built for breweries or sugar refineries, were later divided into numerous small, dark rooms for families to live in. These conditions contributed to high disease and death rates. Quote, "The stenches from the horrible foul cellars, with their infernal system of sewage, must needs poison the tenants all the way up to the fifth floor. The well-worn rut of the dead wagon and the ambulance to the gate, for the tenants died there like flies in all seasons, and a tenth of its population was always in the hospital. The Tenant House Commission, long afterward, called the worst of the barracks, quote, infant slaughterhouses, and showed by reference to the mortality list that they killed one in every five babies born in them. If there is an open space between them, the tenements, it is never more than a slit of or foot or so wide, and gets to be the receptacle of garbage and filth of every kind, so that any opening made for the purposes of ventilation becomes a source of greater danger than if there were none, end quote. Although advances had been made by the early 1900s, many still lived in abysmal sanitary conditions. Some tenements were furnished with indoor facilities, but they were often shared by multiple families. Tales of despair and suffering were commonplace among the working poor. Struggle for survival was a daily affair. People were often close to financial and physical collapse. Poor planning with the ever-increasing number of businesses and population led to haphazard city organization. Businesses of all types, including any of their hazardous environmental byproducts, were built alongside crowded living quarters. So the lack of health regulations and zoning rules resulted in a dangerous and demoralizing environment for the working class people. In 1861, an article on U.S. cities and parks in the Atlantic Monthly described the situation in cities. Quote, narrow and crooked streets, want a proper sewage and ventilation, the absence of forethought in providing open spaces for the recreation of the people, the allowance of intramural within the walls of the building, burials and fetid nuances such as slaughterhouses and manufacturing of offensive stuff have converted cities into pestilent enclosures. And what did Jefferson say? Great cities are great sores. Large numbers of family dwelled within poorly constructed houses. There was no running water and no toilets. An entire street would share one outdoor pump and a couple of outdoor, what were called privy vaults. Those are outhouses. In 1934, Professor Arthur Cole described how some inhabitants in New York and Boston in the 1850s lived in dark cellars overrun with vermin. Quote, while the larger cities possessed handsome residential districts in which the streets were paved and kept clean and the sewage was properly cared for, there was always and also crowded foreign quarters, veritable hives of humanity lacking ordinary comforts and often even necessities. In New York in 1850, they had 8,141 cellar shelters, 18,456 persons. There was also one about the same in Boston, which only has a 20th of the population, lived in damp, dark, ill-vented, vermin-infested underground rooms. And by the end of the war, meaning the Civil War, 15,000 tenement houses had been built in New York, many of them hardly more than fever nests, end quote. The working classes inhabited the most deplorable housing, which was described by Frederick Engels in 1844. Engels visited the slums while in Manchester, England, and heard the horrors he observed. He described the people he encountered in London and other towns in England, quote, these pale, lank, narrow-chested, hollow-eyed ghosts whom one passes at every step, these languid, flabby faces, incapable of the slightest energetic expression I have seen in such startling numbers. Hordes of people crowded beneath smoldering, water-rotting roofs or burrowed among the rats of clammy cellars. Roy Porter, a British historian noted for his work on the history of medicine, wrote about the plight of millions of people in the newly industrialized cities. Quote, for millions, entire lives, albeit often very short ones, were passed in new industrial cities of dreadful night with all too typical sociopathology, foul housing, often in flooded cellars, gross overcrowding, atmospheric water supply non-existent or polluted, overflowing cesspools, contaminated pumps, poverty, hunger, fatigue, and abjection everywhere. Such conditions, comparable to today's third world shanty towns or refugee camps, bred rampant sickness of every kind. Appalling neonatal, infant, and child mortality accompanied the child labor in mines and factories, life expectation low. Contemporary writers at the time tried to call attention to the plight of the wretched poor and their terrible living conditions. Andrew Mearns and William Preston wrote about the poor in their 1883 book, The Bitter Cry of Outcast London, An Inquiry into the Conditions of Abject Poverty. Quote, few who will read these pages have any conception of what these pestilent-ridden human rookeries are, where tens of thousands are crowded together amidst horrors which call to mind what we have heard of the middle passages of the slave ship. To get them, you have to penetrate courts reeking of poisonous gases arising from accumulation of sewage and refuge scattered in all directions and often flowing beneath your feet. Many of them, which the sun never penetrates, which are never visited by a breath of fresh air, and which rarely know the virtues of a drop of cleansed water. You have to ascertain rotted staircases, which threaten to give any beneath you a break. You have to grope your way along dark and filthy passages swarming with vermin. Then you're not driven back by the intolerable stench, and you gain admittance to the dens in which these thousands of beings who belong, as much as you, to the race for whom Christ died, herd together. In conclusion, the extremely stressful conditions rapidly aged the poor working-class people. Those who escaped death from disease or disability at an early age often only lived into their 30s. Quote, among the laboring classes, life expectancy remained very low, little more than 30 years of age, and from 1830s, photographs show working people looking old by their 30s or 40s, as poor nutrition, illness, and bad living conditions and gross overwork took their toll. Clean water, proper sewage treatment, fresh air did not exist in these areas. Without any sanitary infrastructure, human and animal waste would flow into the streets, ending up in the local streams and rivers, which happened also to be the only water people drank. Sanitary facilities designed for smaller populations failed. Cesspools overflowed and seeped into local water supplies. Quote, the manner in which the great multitude of the poor is treated by society today is revolting. They are drawn into the large cities where they breathe a poorer atmosphere than in the country. They are relegated to districts which, by reason of the method of construction, are worse ventilated than others. They are deprived of all means of cleanliness, of water itself, since pipes are laid only when paid for, and the rivers are so polluted they are useless for such purposes. They are obliged to throw an offal and garbage, all dirty water, often all disgustingly, so right into the streets, being without other means of disposing them. They are thus compelled to infect the region of their own dwellings. End quote. Tomorrow I'll continue. So the next time you hear a so-called expert on health give all the credit to a vaccine, by the end of this discussion in 5 days, you will know the truth that Edward Jenner was a fraud. He was a fake at every level. And that there were no scientific studies, none, that verified that the smallpox vaccine was even made from smallpox, whether it was made from horse grease. But that is to come. And we want to thank Dr. Susanna Humphreys and Roman Bistrinic and their important book, Dissolving Illusion, for their scholarship. Let us now go to my guest standing by, Professor Harvey Wasserman. As I mentioned earlier, he's a professor of history at Columbus State College and Capital University. He is an investigative journalist, and he has been a major voice for the anti-war and anti-nuclear movements for over 40 years. He is also a senior advisor for Greenpeace and Nuclear Information Resource, and he has many books, including George W. Bush versus the Superpower of Peace, and most recently an e-book introduced by Greg Palast, Will the GOP Steal America's Next Election? Nice to have you with us today, Harvey.
Great to be with you, Gary.
Harvey, I was reading recently an article from the Washington Post that four climate change scientists stated that nuclear power is the way to go to reduce greenhouse emissions and climate change. The article, also published in the UK, claims that wind, solar, and other renewables can't provide the power necessary for the future. And by the way, these four scientists include NASA's James Hansen. So give us your position on the fact that Hansen and others have said nuclear, when you and I and many other environmentalists and scientists no, that is not the way to go.
Well, these guys need to go to Fukushima. They've done no research. They're blinded to, for some reason, to the utter catastrophe that's happening to our planet now. And this is a grotesquely irresponsible statement on their part. The reality is that solar power, wind power, tidal, geothermal, ocean thermal, all the solartopian sources of renewable green power are more than ready to take on powering our planet. We don't need nuclear power. It makes global warming worse, but far worse than that for scientists and about in the middle of the catastrophe at Fukushima, where thousands and thousands of tons of water contaminated with radioactive cesium and other isotopes are pouring into the ocean every day, and where the spent fuel rods at Unit 4 are in danger of falling to the ground and igniting, and where three molten cores from melted nuclear reactors have gone into the ground with location unknown. For scientists to come out, alleged scientists to come out and say we need more nuclear power is really insane, and I use that word advisedly. Anyone who's reading about Fukushima, and I urge your listeners to go to nukefree.org, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E.org, where I post articles constantly about Fukushima. Anybody who knows anything about Fukushima knows that we need every available hand to help figure out how to somehow contain the catastrophe that's destroying our planet. I mean, the reports that are starting to come in from the Pacific Ocean are horrifying. We're looking at an apocalyptic situation here at Fukushima. And for these guys to come out, Gary, and say we need more nuclear plants, it defies the imagination.
Let me, I appreciate that, Harvey. Just today from CBS News, quote, radiation from Japan nuclear power plant arrives on Alaska's coast. Scientists at the University of Alaska are concerned about radiation leaking from Japan's damaged Fukushima nuclear plant and the lack of a monitoring plan. Some radiation has arrived in northern Alaska and along the west coast. That's raised concerns over contamination of fish and wildlife. More may be heading towards coastal communities like Haines and Skagway. And Douglas Dasher, a researcher at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, says radiation levels in Alaska waters could reach Cold War levels. Quote, the levels they are projecting in some of the models are in the ballpark of what we saw in the North Pacific in the 1960s. Also, John Kelly, professor emeritus at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, says he's not sure contamination will reach dangerous levels for humans, but says without better data, you don't know. Well, here's what we do know. We know that we're seeing the death of pregnant killer whales that you've never seen before, that polar bears and walruses are ending up with oozing infections that they've never seen before, that that pups, sea pups, are dying, and that 100% in Alaska and Canada, 100% of eels and sardines and other fish have been contaminated. So they're living in complete denial. One other thing, too. They're saying that wind is the way. I would agree that wind would be one contributing factor if it was only in three areas. Up in the mountains of the Continental Divide, away from population. On east the East Coast, far enough out, and the West Coast, far enough out, so it would not impact the immediate environment. But then, if you have those same wind power close to humans, it's now causing wind power syndrome, where people can't sleep. It's causing constant agitation. It devalues their property. It's killing millions of birds, and it produces very little return for what it costs. And one of these towers is as big as it's over 400 feet, so it's huge. And there's a lot of breakdown of them. And there's already a lot of that have broken down, don't work, into the thousands, including in Hawaii. Better to have wave power, which is completely non-polluting, is inexpensive, and you have an endless source of it. Geothermal, which hasn't even been used in the United States yet, we have thousands upon thousands of geothermal springs that can provide that. Solar, especially with the new solar technology that is available. So they're not promoting what they should. And the unfortunate part is, Harvey, they're using the crony capitalism, the people who are on the inside of giving the right amount of money, who got the exclusive contracts to do the solar and weren't doing it in the way they should have, instead of promoting small solar advantages and promoting the use of smaller solar units, especially in sun states. Your thoughts, please.
Well, the science of renewable energy is advancing, I think, sort of along the lines of Murphy's Law. Murphy's Law was that computing power would double every 18 months or so. We're seeing a similar phenomenon with renewables where the technology is just blowing spectacularly ahead. We don't want to be dependent on any one single source. And we have solar, geothermal. We want the mix. Biofuels are at a takeoff point as well. And the bottom line is that nuclear is an utter apocalyptic catastrophe. Reading about Fukushima every day is probably the most depressing thing I've ever done in my life. The reports that you are giving from Alaska are very much what we would expect, given the amounts of radiation, the tens of thousands of gallons of radioactive water pouring into the ocean from Fukushima. The government of Japan is about to pass a state secrets act, which will make it impossible to get information from Fukushima. I mean, one of the problems at Chernobyl was we couldn't find out what was going on. This is the Soviet Union, Union's position on free speech, but Japan is about to turn into the Soviet Union without the social programs. I mean, Prime Minister Abe of Japan has been much less open about Fukushima than Gorbachev was about Chernobyl. And this is an incredibly dangerous situation. And for scientists, using climate as a modus to advocate nuclear power, it's horrifying. We are in a very, very dangerous situation here, Gary. Unless something is done at Fukushima, human life really has never faced a more serious, immediate threat than the ongoing catastrophe of Fukushima. God forbid there should be another earthquake there that would bring down the fuel rods at Unit 4. God forbid, we know that the site was hit recently by not one but two typhoons. 10 inches of water were dropped on the site during one of the typhoons, flushing still more tens of thousands of gallons of radioactive water into the Pacific. The list goes on and on. All nuclear plants all over the world need to be shut. I mean, the really gross, grotesque thing is that Fukushima is not even a worst-case scenario. The earthquake that caused the tsunami was a 9.0, which is very, very big, of course, but it happened more than 100 kilometers away from Fukushima. If that earthquake had hit closer to Fukushima, it could have rubbleized that site, and we'd have there is a smoldering radioactive ruin. And that could happen at any nuclear plant, including the Indian Point reactors, a mere 45 miles north of New York City, which the Nuclear Regulatory Commission said are the American reactors most at risk from earthquake impact.
Harvey, imagine if there was an accident at Indian Point and the wind took the radiation north to the New York watershed at Walk Hill. You could end up contaminating all the water for New York City and its suburbs. I don't believe people understand how dangerous these nuclear facilities are. I'm sorry that Dr. Hansen, who has done so many important things, and I commend him on his fight for the Appalachian communities against the strip mining, but on this one, he should do his homework. There are lots of people out there who could help him, and today, those four people who are now pro-nuclear, we're sending them a copy of Knocking on the Devil's Door, which you're in, and also letting him know, go to nukefree.org. And also, I know this Thursday you're going to be at the UN presenting 150,000 signatures to demand a global effort to deal with Fukushima and its contents. So thanks for all that you do, Harvey, and we look forward to sharing another program.
Gary, thank you. And we'll see you at 3 o'clock. I'll be on with my show.
Yes. Harvey also does a program on the Progressive Radio Network on Mondays at 3 p.m., one of our most popular programs. We're coming up to the end of the program. I want to thank you all for listening in. Every day we try to bring you the issues on the environment, on health, on how we can make it a better world, and also bring you the truth about the issues. Boy, I have a powerful program tonight at 7 o'clock. Whoa, got a whistleblower on. I'm going to talk about the truth behind... I'm not even going to say it. tune in over the internet tonight at 7 o'clock for the Progressive Commentary. You're going to hear some revelations that will shock you. And for everyone else, but I am going to deal with someone who is a former top retired State Department official and who served in embassies in Uzbekistan and Nicaragua and actually won the award of heroism. So, but they're going to say some stuff that will, many of the people listening will find, well, it confirms their worst fears. Otherwise, thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Now let's say hello to Lou Ann Panessi, standing by. Hello, Ann.
Hello, Gary. Well, first I want to let you know that I've been getting lots of emails from people. And if people want to email me, I'm at whnn@aol.com. I'm happy to get your emails that are related to what you're talking about on the air. I have one girl, Lorraine, here from our Florida retreat, who said that her hemoglobin A1C dropped down to normal levels and she lost 15 pounds since August and wants to thank you and I for helping her to get back on a healthy track lifestyle. So that's always great to hear. And as well, we have a lot of people that are familiar with the whole Pacifica organization. Some of your audience I know may not be, but with all of this listener-sponsored radio, especially right now, WBAI, I'm getting a lot of emails from people that are asking about if WBAI is salvageable, because there's lots of emails flying around now that they're talking about leasing the station, and will we have to do that after people are emailing, you know, we've been working our asses off to support the station, and it doesn't look like it's going to be viable anymore, and you know, what is the future of listener funded radio like WBAI and the other Pacifica stations? But right now the big focus is on WBAI.
I can't tell you what's going to happen to the station. I don't know. We would all like to see it thrive, everyone. That's why we work so hard. But in order to thrive, you have to have a simple formula. You have to have a large, diverse base that can listen to multiple programs and sustain that listenership throughout the day. At least 10 strong programs of about equal size. You have to have the capacity to raise funds from those people, but without overburdening it. Certainly no more than 2 weeks every 4 months is necessary. You have to have management that is professional and is able to deal with people. Program director that knows the kind of programming that is important for people to listen to, but also is unique and distinguishes itself from being an NPR or a PBS or Fox or anyone else. And you have to have management that has a background in management. And then you have to have a good cash reserve, because to promote any new program, if you had Phil Donahue or Ralph Nader, whoever it may be, who is popular and well-known, come on, it would take at least a year to a year and a half with a $100,000 or $200,000 promotional budget to build them an audience that can means they would have time then to help the station. Well, that's what would help the station. And also making sure that you don't overplay programs, you get premiums out in a timely manner. None of those are capable right now. The station is broke. The foundation is broke. There are no management there. There's no station manager. There's no program director. And if there were, it would likely come from a completely politicized local station board with some very competent people who have professional backgrounds, but they're more often than not, they are fought so that quality management is negated so that you have politically correct management. And then, since you have no money and you have no PR campaign and you have isolated an audience, BAI is not unknown. It's just the people who do know it historically and have stopped listening to it, there's a reason. And you better talk with the people who stopped supporting you to understand what lesson you can learn. It became too extreme in its identity politics, its racial profiling politics, its unprofessional standards. So it created the ideal audience for a tiny group of programmers, but it doesn't represent Lou Hill's image, and I don't believe that that's possible at this time. I would like to think it could be, but I don't see anything currently that would allow that shift, because they don't have the money, the management, or the shows that will cause that cohesiveness to go forward. I hope I'm wrong, but I believe that unless there's some radical change the next 2 or 3 or 4 months, it'll be leased. Okay, thank you. We're out of time. Let's say hello to Eutrice Lead. Hi, Eutrice.
Hello, Gary. Not to mention that it ought to be said, I mean, the truth about WBAI needs to be told at some point.
I hope it happens.
It would be disclosed where at least $1 million just is committed to one individual with one program for funding for intellectual property hijacked from the system. But that's a whole other story. Today, I'm talking about Haiti unraveling further into chaos and about the grudge match between Democrats and Republicans over the Stand Your Ground laws.
Great. We look forward to it. Eutrice Lead right now.